Okay, brethren, well, good morning once again to those of you across the Atlantic, and good afternoon to those of you over here in England. We continue with our Bible study of the book of James, and as always, you'll need your $50 bill handy to act as your bookmark as we flip backwards and forwards through various other scriptures. Now, last week, we went through James chapter 1, and perhaps one of the key passages we looked at was James 1 verses 2, 3 and 4. Probably worth reading those just one more time before we move on, because the message that James gives us here is very, very important. And remember, we said last week that James would be the first book or letter you would come across in the inspired order of the New Testament. After you've done Matthew and Mark and Luke and John and the book of Acts, the very first next book or letter is James, a very powerful letter with much practical, common sense, day-to-day instruction for us. So chapter 1, and just a quick recount of verses 2, 3, and 4. My brethren, says James, count it all joy when you fall into various trials or tests or tribulations, knowing that the testing of your faith produces not more faith, but produces patience. This characteristic of being constant, unswerving, unchanging. Verse 4, but let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, thoroughly mature, lacking nothing. And we said last week, we all do hit various difficulties, tests, trials, and God watches how we deal with them. We mentioned that if you're perhaps by mistake given a $100 bill or a $500 bill, if there are such things at the Walmart checkout, God wouldn't send that to you, but you'd certainly be interested in whether you pass the test. Would you honestly give the money back, or would you think this is interesting? If I quietly stick that in my pocket, race out the door, I'm $100 wealthier. So many difficulties hit us in our lives, but God watches to see how we deal with them. And instruction from James in verses 2, 3, and 4 is be constant. Set your sights, keep on going, do not move to the left or to the right, but maintain your faith and be constant day in, day out. Okay, now moving on to chapter 2 and starting in verse 1. My brethren, do not hold the faith of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, with partiality. In the next few verses, James deals with the subject of partiality, which really means showing personal favoritism to other people. One translation actually translates that as, don't show personal favoritism to other people. That's what partiality means. You're treating one person very different to another person. Not so much that we necessarily, well, we've all got friends, people we feel more close to perhaps in the congregation and so on, but you shouldn't treat people differently in that sense. It'll be explained as we go along. Verse 2, for if there should come into your assembly, or church shall we say, a man with gold rings in fine apparel, and there should also come in a poor man in filthy clothes, and you pay attention, look up to, admire, the one wearing the fine clothes and say to him, oh, you come and sit here in a good place. And you say to the poor man, well, stand over there somewhere, chappy, or sit here at my footstool, implying that you've got a very comfortable position. In fact, you've got such a comfortable chair, you even get a footstool. And this guy, you're not offering him your footstool, he can sit on the floor by your footstool. So you can see here that, you know, two people walk into the church, into our lives, and one we treat with enormous respect, great admiration, look up to, what a wonderful person. And the other person, who happens to be, in this case, just a bit poorer, that we treat as, we almost dismiss, sit there on the floor somewhere, will you, if you can find some space? Verse 4, have you not shown partiality? My margin says, have you not differentiated among yourselves and become judges with evil thoughts? Because, frankly, you're not being fair. You're not treating these people as being equal in God's sight and equal with ourselves. The one person you're looking up to because they look good, they've got a fine business suit, a starched white shirt, a nice colorful tie, a handkerchief in their pocket, gold rings on every finger. They're oozing wealth and prosperity. And, oh my word, how important they are. I must get to know them. Another person walks in, pretty humble dress, and, well, ignore them. Let somebody else talk to them. And James says, this isn't right, brethren. My brethren, he says, you shouldn't differentiate that way. You're judging, and you're not judging in a right sense. You are showing favoritism, and that's not right. Verse 5, listen, my beloved brethren. Has God not chosen the poor of this world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom which he promised to those who love him? You know, God, we know elsewhere it says, not many wise men, not many mighty men, not many noble men are called. So God has mostly chosen in this day and age people of relatively humble background. Not entirely so. There are some mighty, there are some wise in the world, there are some noble. And of course it would be as wrong to perversely discriminate against a prosperous person in the church as it would to discriminate against a poor person. It's discrimination, it is personal favoritism that is wrong, whether it's towards a poor person, which is more commonly the way it would be. But, you know, in our day and age, the upside down world we live in, sometimes poor people look down on rich people. It's just incredible. I remember many years ago in our local church, there was a reasonably elderly gentleman. At least I was much younger then, so he seemed more elderly. I think I'm not too far off his age now, as it happens. But he seemed a bit elderly at the time. He was a married man. And again, I wouldn't have said he was particularly wealthy. He was just comfortable in my estimation. But there was another man in the church who was dirt poor, lived in a one-room property, and he, the guy in the one-room property, looked down on, criticized, and condemned this elderly gentleman. Now, the elderly man, possibly in his 60s at the time, I think, had a heart attack and was quite seriously ill for a few months. But thankfully, regained his health and continued to attend church for years afterwards. But when he had his heart attack, this poor guy living in a one-room property, he said, serves him right. You know, God's teaching him a lesson or two. That's brought him down. And yet, as I listen to this guy and just think, you know, what sort of attitude have we got here? Here's a person who's looking down on a man who's more comfortably off and saying it serves. I mean, you know, was he speaking out of a love for this older man? Was he speaking out of a gratitude that the man was experiencing something which would teach him the truth of God and bring him to his senses and so on? Not at all. He was just envious, jealous of the man's simple prosperity. And when he had his heart attack, oh, it serves him right. That's God bringing him down. And really, it was quite vile. So James here is not saying that we should discriminate just against the poor and so on. We should not discriminate at all, poor or rich. But carrying on in verse 5, listen, my beloved brethren, has God not chosen the poor of this world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom which he promised to those who love him? To which the answer is, yes, God has called many, many, many poor people, mostly poorer people. But you have dishonored the poor man. Do not the rich oppress you and drag you into the courts? Well, not the rich brethren, obviously they weren't doing that, but by and large, it was the rich people with the money that were causing problems to James's readers. Do they not blaspheme that noble name by which you were called? In other words, on the whole, he was saying you'll find the rich people are causing lots of problems, and God's called the poor people, so how dare you treat the poorer people and dismiss them that way, that's entirely wrong. And you suck up to the rich people, even though, by and large, they're the ones that are causing you the most trouble. You've got no sense at all. It's totally ridiculous what you're doing. Verse 8, if you really fulfill, you know, fill to the full, the royal law, according to the scripture, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, you do well. But if you show partiality, favoritism, you commit sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors. So James says, look, the royal law says you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And he calls it the royal law. It is the important law. It is the law that comes from the King of Kings. And it says we are to love our neighbors as ourselves. So therefore, if you treat one person purely because of his bank account as being, you know, second rate or even a third rate citizen, and the person in the fine suit or the lady with the gold jewelry and the expensive Breiton handbag and the lady with the expensive shoes on her feet, if you treat her as being, you know, important because of her wealthy clothes, and you dismiss the other lady who happens to be, you know, poor and humble, you're not loving your neighbor. You're being partial, you are discriminatory, and it's not at all good. Keep your place there with your $50 bill. Let's turn to Mark chapter 12. Have a quick look at this royal law. Mark chapter 12. And verse 28 through, I guess, 33. Mark 12, 28, looking at this royal law that says you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Then one of the scribes came, and having heard them reasoning together, perceiving that Jesus had answered them well, asked him, which is the first commandment of all? What is the most important of all the commandments? You might say, what is the royal law, the royal commandment? Jesus answered him, the first of all the commandments is, Hear, O Israel, the Eternal our God, the Eternal is one, and you shall love the Eternal your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. This is the first commandment. And we know the first four of the Ten Commandments give us more details on how we go about loving our God with all of our hearts. But then verse 31, and the second like it is this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these. And the last six of the commandments describe in a bit more detail how we should love our neighbor as ourselves. And Jesus says, you know, these are the two key ones. So the scribe said to him, well said, teacher, you have spoken the truth, for there is one God, and there is no other but He, and to love Him with all the heart, with all the understanding, with all the soul, and with all the strength, and to love one's neighbor as oneself is more than all the whole burnt offerings and sacrifices. So when Jesus saw that he answered wisely, he said to him, you are not far from the kingdom of God. And after that, no one dared question him. Okay, back to James. So we see the law tells us to love our neighbors, and James is saying, look, you know, it's not the hearers of the law, but the doers who are going to be blessed. We saw that last week. Repeatedly, James says, don't just listen to the law. Don't just read the law. You've got to be doers. You've got to be out there active. And if you're in the congregation and you're treating one person better than another and being partial and showing such favoritism, then you're not complying with the law. You're a hearer and not a doer. Verse 10, for whoever shall keep the whole law and yet stumble in one point, he is guilty of all. For he who said, do not commit adultery, also said, do not murder. So I think we know what the royal law is, because there's two of the key commandments. Now, if you do not commit adultery, but you do murder, you have become a transgressor of the law. So as it says there, if you keep the whole law, but stumble in one point, you're guilty of all. And it's worth remembering, I guess, and probably most professing Christians wouldn't want to hear this, but one of the points of the law is remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. So if you keep the whole law but stumble at the fourth commandment, the Sabbath commandment, then you are guilty of all. Verse 12, so speak and so do as those who will be judged by the law of liberty. So it's called the royal law. It's also called the law of liberty because, you know, sin, which is breaking God's law, holds us in bondage. It brings ultimately misery into our lives and eventually, of course, death. We saw that also in James chapter 1, that sin and desire, it brings forth sin, and then that's full grown, it brings forth death and so on. But God's law sets us free from that. It's the law of liberty. But it says, verse 12, so speak and so do. In the Greek, that's in the sort of the present tense, meaning so be speaking and so be doing. It's a continuous thing. We don't speak once and do once. You know, James is saying, you know, be a doer, which of course is exactly what we read across there in James chapter 1 and verse 22. It says, but be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. And James's concern was that if you sit there in church, you know, so to speak, you know, Sabbath in and Sabbath out and turn up for the holy days and so on, and you hear and hear and hear, you may deceive yourself into thinking that, well, I'm okay with God because, you know, I'm there. I hear his word frequently. James says, actually, if you hear, even if you listen attentively, but don't do, you've deceived yourself. You've fooled yourself. God's not fooled. So here in chapter 2, verse 12, he says, so be speaking and so be doing. In other words, don't just talk the talk, but be a doer, because we'll be judged by the law of liberty. Verse 13, for judgment is without mercy, whoops, to the one who has shown no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment. You know, if we want to be partial to other people, if we want to dismiss other people and treat them as second-rate citizens because they don't match up to our expectations, if we want to be hard and harsh with other people, which is what he's talking about here, let's remember that God's watching. God says we should love our neighbors as ourselves. That's in his law. We be judged by that law. If you want to treat people in a uncaring manner, then no surprise if we get the same level of judgment back again. Keep your place there and turn to Matthew chapter 6. Matthew chapter 6, cutting into the so-called Sermon on the Mount, but certainly Jesus' detailed instructions to his disciples. Matthew chapter 6 and verses 14 and 15. This is just after the model prayer that Jesus gave to his disciples. And in verse 14 we read, for if you forgive men their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive men their trespasses, oh, neither will your Father forgive your trespasses. Red letters in my Bible. That's Jesus talking, and he says we need to be very careful not to hold things against other people. It doesn't say there you should encourage people to trespass, of course. It's not our job to either by our example lead them into sin or by our careless words guide them or instruct them in sinning. But when people have sinned and are looking to repent and so on, you know, we should be quick to forgive. And if we're quick to forgive and have a forgiving attitude, a merciful attitude towards other people and their weaknesses, then fine. You know, God will be as generous towards us as we are towards others. But if we are hard-hearted, you know, I'm not allowing for any weakness in that person. They've done wrong and I'm going to hold it against them for the rest of my living days. Ooh, well, if we don't forgive other people their mistakes, why, God says, should I be so forgiving of your mistakes? Because you will make them. Okay, back to James chapter 2, moving on to verse 14. And James continues, in a sense, to expand on this problem he sees about the brethren being hearers and talkers and not doers. The one thing they have been doing in the first part of chapter 2 was the wrong thing. They've been showing partiality. Verse 14, "What does it profit, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but does not have works?" Doesn't do anything different. Can faith save him? Faith alone save him? He's a person that, frankly, his life or her life is no different to anybody else's. They claim to be going God's way. They claim to be filled with God's Holy Spirit, but their lives are totally unchanged. What they do is what they did before. There's no change. Verse 15, "If a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food," in other words, somebody has got needs, in this case quite desperate needs, "and one of you says to them, 'Depart in peace, be warmed and filled,'" you know, great sentiments, "but you do not give them the things which are needed for the body, what does it profit?" The answer is nothing at all. If the person's hungry, you know, pleasant words won't fill their belly up. If they're freezing cold, pleasant words won't make them feel comfortable all of a sudden. So he's saying, look, words are just empty things. What God's looking for in our lives is not just talking the talk. It's not being hearers only. It's God's looking for a little bit of action from you. Thus, verse 17, also, "faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead." One translation refers to faith without corresponding actions. You know, faith, we can all talk about faith, but how do you know anybody's got faith? If they just talk about it, sit there in the chair talking about it all the time, even writing letters about it all the time, how do you know? How does God know? How do you know yourself you've got faith? Just talking the talk is easy. It's living by faith that becomes a little bit more of a challenge. Verse 18, "But someone will say that you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by my works." You'll find out I've got faith because you'll see it in action. And when you see the works, you'll know that those works demonstrate my faith, my beliefs. It's because of what I believe that you'll see the action that follows. But you just tell me about your faith with no actions, and it's, you know, where's the proof? Where's the evidence? Verse 19, "You believe that there is one God. You do well, but even the demons believe and tremble." One translation says the demons shudder with fear. So, I mean, belief, just belief, without corresponding actions, isn't that great? You believe in God, says James, big deal. Satan believes in God, doesn't obey him, doesn't act in a way that pleases God, doesn't serve God, doesn't go out of his way to help other people and obey that royal law of liberty by sort of serving and helping, by supporting, but he certainly believes in God. The demons believe in God. So you think believing in God is a big deal? Sorry, says James. You know, James is really quite tough here. He's saying your cheap talk isn't a big thing with God. God's looking for corresponding actions that go along with your faith. Verse 20, "But do you want to know, O foolish man, that faith without works is dead?" Faith without corresponding actions is dead. You know, there could be times, you know, when perhaps we've gone to God in prayer, hopefully a prayer of faith, asking for God's intervention in some area. It might be perhaps healing. We've gone to God and said, look, you know, it says in your scriptures here that you are God our healer. Jesus, you took our infirmities, bear away our sicknesses. By your wounds, it says that we were healed. I've been anointed, and I'm going to stand in faith. And I'm going to believe unswervingly for my healing. And somebody comes to you a couple of days later and says, how are you getting on? Oh, it's just dreadful. Oh, I'm getting worse every single day. I'm getting worse and worse. Now, at that point, there's a bit of a conflict because we're believing and trusting in God to heal us, But when we're asked how we're doing, all we can talk about is it's getting worse every day, the lump's getting bigger, I'm getting weaker and weaker. And in a sense, our words, our actions don't seem to correspond with our alleged faith. Perhaps we've got a difficult situation coming up. Remember at the beginning it says, count it all joy when you fall into diverse trials. So some situation comes along, perhaps it's at work. There's rumors of our place of employment might be closing down. We may become unemployed. And we go to God in prayer, asking in faith for wisdom. And of course, we know the answer. If we ask for wisdom, it says God will give to all men liberally and upbraid not. But we must ask in faith, believing, with no doubting. So, situation comes along. Perhaps it's a family situation. Perhaps it's to do with our work, whatever it might be. We go to God and ask him for wisdom, strong in faith. And of course, somebody says to us a week later, how's your situation looking? Oh, it's grim. Oh, I've no idea what to do about it. Ask for wisdom with no doubting. And then we say, I've no idea what to do about it. Well, if we've no idea, we didn't really believe for the wisdom. Otherwise, we'd have said, well, it's a tricky situation. I can't see the way forward at the moment. But God is going to show me the way through it, because that's action, words that correspond with our alleged faith. Okay, moving on then. James then refers to a couple of examples that everybody would have been aware of to show how, you know, faith does have these associated actions. It's not just pretty words mouthed in a church environment. Faith is for real, in the real world. And he uses Abraham first of all, and then Rahab. Verse 21. Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered Isaac his son on the altar? Now we know the story there. Abraham took Isaac up on God's instructions to apparently sacrifice him. And of course, you know, thankfully God intervened at the end and Isaac wasn't sacrificed. But Abraham had quite a strong test there. And one of the few occasions when God actually sent a direct test on a person. But of course, Abraham was to be a very, very important man in the whole history of the universe, quite frankly. He wasn't just a you and a me. He was the man through whom Jesus would ultimately be born to bless the whole earth. He was a man through whom the birthright blessings of today were to come. So a special test in a sense required for Abraham. But verse 21 says, was not Abraham justified by works when he offered Isaac his son on the altar? The answer is, well, yes and no. The works weren't just works. Abraham was willing to do that because Abraham had the faith. Abraham believed God. Abraham knew God. Abraham trusted God. And the actions that Abraham took were based upon his faith in God. So really it was faith and works going hand in glove. Verse 22. Do you see that faith was working together with his works? And by works, faith was made perfect or complete. And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness, and he was called the friend of God. You see then that a man is justified by works, and not by faith only. And the point that James is making is that if Abraham hadn't had any faith, he certainly wouldn't have done the works. Abraham's faith was demonstrated by his works. There can be no question, I think, that at that time that Satan was very interested in Abraham and watching very closely and no doubt doing his usual to try and derail God's purpose and plan. So God was able to show here to Satan, to all the demons, able to show to all the good angels, able to show to you and me, as we read about it, you know, centuries later, that Abraham had faith. How do we know? How do you know that Abraham had tremendous faith? How do I know it? How does Satan know it? Obvious. Abraham proved his faith by his corresponding actions, by his words. How does God know whether you've got faith or I've got faith? Not by listening to us, you know, blethering away after services one day, all talk. It's what we do. Is it consistent? Do we do what we talk about? Or do we, have a forked tongue? We sort of say one thing, but perhaps do another. Okay, moving on to verse 25, another example that James used, a lady this time, Rahab. Verse 25, likewise, in a similar manner, in other words, was not Rahab the harlot, fancy choosing a prostitute as an example of faith, likewise, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out another way? They went out the window. I think they came in the door, left by the window. I guess that was the other way. And you think, oh, hang on a second. I mean, Rahab was she was a lady of the night. She had a big red lamp outside her door way back there in Jericho. How come, in what way, was Rahab an example of faith and works? Well, put your $50 bill there a moment, and we'll turn to Hebrews chapter 11, which you'll recognize as the faith chapter. Hebrews 11 and verse 30 and 31. You know, Paul's going through a list of all the heroes of faith who one assumes had corresponding actions, whether it was Noah, who showed his faith by building an ark when there'd never been a flood presumably before, and he builds this great big ark in the middle of dry land, miles and miles and miles from the sea. That took faith, but he knew he had faith because he was busy building a big ark, even though there'd been no floods, no serious problems. That was faith with corresponding actions. But now we're looking at Rahab in particular, verse 30. By faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they were encircled for 7 days. They marched around for 7 days blowing their bugles. And if they hadn't done that, if there had been no corresponding actions, okay. By faith the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe, when she'd received the spies with peace. Okay, verse 31, so the harlot Rahab must have believed, because it says, by faith, the harlot or the prostitute Rahab did not perish with those who didn't believe, when she'd received the spies with peace. So she apparently believed and did something. If we go over to Joshua chapter 2, we can pick up just a few of the details. Joshua chapter 2. Now we'll just read a couple of 3 verses rather than the whole story to save a bit of time. Joshua chapter 2. It's actually headed in my Bible as the faith of Rahab. And really, you'll see there is faith here. Faith with corresponding actions. Starting in verse 8. The two sort of spies were that had been sent out to spy Jericho were in Jericho, and word had leaked out they were there, so they're now in hiding. Verse 8, so before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof, that's Rahab, and said to the men, I know that the Eternal has given you the land, that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. So here's an expression, really, of the belief of this woman. You know, I know, she says, I don't doubt, I know that the Eternal has given you this land. I know it. Verse 10, for we have heard, and how does faith come? It says faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. For we have heard how the Eternal dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. Neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you, for the Eternal, your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. So you see, you know, Rahab caught on, at least at the simple level, to the fact that the God of Israel was the God. She understood and believed that the land was being given to Israel. She believed that, and she took action. And she saved the lives, helped them escape, and of course was rewarded in due course. So back to James chapter 2. So we can see that, you know, Rahab didn't just talk the talk, and you knew that she was a believer in the God of Israel, not in the sort of a spiritual sense that you and I have to be, but she was a believer in God delivering Israel, giving them the victory. She believed, at least at that level, and her faith in that was demonstrated by the corresponding actions. She was not a hearer only. She was a hearer and a doer, and she was blessed in her doing, as you will be, as I will be. You know, God's looking for us to live properly. He doesn't just want, you know, Christians that talk, and don't deliver. Verse 26, for as the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without works is dead also. Quite a challenge to us. You know, faith is not something that's unimportant. You know, you remember the case of, I think, when Israel was at the very edge of the promised land for the very first time, the time they didn't go on over, they sent out the 12 spies, and, you know, two spies came back, Joshua and Caleb, and said, great, the land is indeed flowing with milk and honey. Let's go there. Let's go on across. You know, if you like, their faith was being demonstrated by their words and by the actions they were proposing to take. But the other 10 spies said, oh no, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear, it's a beautiful land, all right, it's flowing with milk and honey, but, I mean, the people are so strong, and they're well armed, and there's plenty of them all over the place, and their cities are, they've got walls, high walls, they're impregnable. Oh, there's no way we can take the land. And God says that was a bad report. It's described as a bad report. Now, it was in a sense a true report. There were many people in the land. They were strong militarily. They did have high walls around their cities. So it was an accurate report in the sense of physically or geographically or militarily. But God says it was a bad report because, frankly, it accused God of not being able to deliver his people and keep his promise. So now you and I would be careful what we say. If we're going to God and asking him for deliverance, for redemption, for healing, for blessings in various areas, and we're standing on our faith, to say that God's not going to do that and say to people, well, it's just getting worse and worse. I can see no way forward. I just don't know what to do. And we're actually giving a bad report. It might be physically, humanly accurate, but it denies God's ability, willingness to get involved, and it frankly denies his promise to respond to our prayers of faith. So we need to be very careful that our faith does get supported by corresponding actions. Okay, moving on now to chapter 3. And chapter 3 is, the context is largely about false teachers, people that want to give us instruction that's not helpful. And there's a couple of other principles tucked away in chapter 3 that will be good for us to look at. But starting off with the main context of the chapter, my brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we, teachers, says James, shall receive a stricter judgment. You know, there's a problem with being a teacher, which is that, you know, an ordinary person, who doesn't have a huge audience of any sort, if they foul up their lives, they tend to foul up their lives. They might also foul up their family, of course, if there's a husband or a wife or a couple of kids. But once somebody becomes an instructor of the many, the danger is that they can mislead many and cause problems to many. And so, you know, God's saying, well, hold on a moment. Don't many people seek to become instructors or teachers? Because if you do, you will be much more severely judged because you're in a position to derail, disturb, and frankly destroy many, many people. In fact, the Greek in verse 1 is, I think the King James is probably a bit more accurate, it says, be not many teachers. It's actually an imperative. One translation, the analytical, says, stop letting so many become teachers. Stop it. Don't do it. It's obviously we do all need teachers, but it says, let not many. Stop letting so many, because teachers can cause so many problems to God's people. We turn to 1 Timothy chapter 1. And of course, it's always been a problem. It's a problem throughout the New Testament. We see that again and again and again. And it's certainly a problem today in God's church. So many instructors, experts, teachers, you fall over them these days. 1 Timothy chapter 1, and starting in verse 5 when we get there. Now, the purpose of the commandment, or the objective of the instruction, is love from a pure heart, from a good conscience, and from sincere faith. So Paul's writing to Timothy saying that the purpose of what I'm telling you is to produce, love, mature, spiritual mind. Verse 6, from which some, having strayed, have turned aside to idle talk, desiring to be teachers of the law, but notice, understanding neither what they say, nor the things which they confidently affirm. There are a large number of men, and I guess a few women as well, who desire to be teachers of God's way of life, happy to give you their opinions as to what you need to be doing about your life, while of course very often their own lives are a disaster. But notice it talks about verse 6, some have strayed from the, if you like, the good way, have turned aside to idle talk. One translation talks about fruitless discussion or futile discourse. Talking, frankly, nonsense. It might be very technical, but it's unhelpful and very often totally inaccurate, useless, meaningless. But these people are actively involved in promoting these ideas, these opinions, which are just, as it says, fruitless and futile discussion. But they desire to be teachers of the law. They want to teach. They want the status of being people that are up there, high up above the brethren, dictating and pontificating about the right way to live and so on and so forth. And unfortunately, they're supported in that because so many of God's people want to hear strange ideas. If we turn to 2 Timothy chapter 4, a few pages across, 2 Timothy chapter 4, and we'll read verses 3 and 4. 2 Timothy chapter 4, starting in verse 3. Paul still writing to Timothy, for the time will come, it will come, he says, when they will not endure sound doctrine, they won't persevere with the truth, but according to their own desires, because they have itching ears, they will heap up for themselves teachers, and they will turn their ears away from the truth and be turned aside to fables. So you've got the worst of both worlds. You get a bunch of God's people whose ears are itching them to find a new revelation, new exciting truth, and you get these people who desire to be teachers, happy to come along and provide this new and exciting revelation. It's a big problem. Back to James chapter 3, and James was already aware of this. So he says, stop letting so many people become teachers. Verse 2, for we all stumble, even James himself, in many things. If anyone does not stumble in word, well, he says, he is a perfect man, able also to bridle the whole body. If you keep your finger then, just look at chapter 1 and verse 26. We read there, if anyone among you thinks he's religious and does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his own heart, this one's religion is useless, empty, vain. So chapter 3 verse 2, James is saying, look, we do have a problem with our mouths, with our tongues, with our words. And if any person, and particularly a teacher, but obviously I think the principle is fairly clear, it applies to us all, especially a teacher, because of the number of people he or she can influence. If anyone does not stumble in word, he is a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body. And you know, bridling our tongues, keeping our tongues in order, is a key challenge. It's a huge challenge, and reveals very much what we're like. Again, if you look, of course, at chapter 1 and verse 19, which we covered last week, it says, therefore, my beloved brethren, because he does care for them, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. And one translation about being slow to speak says really reluctant to speak. You know, don't be too fast to shoot off your mouth or your great insights and ideas. Be reluctant to speak. People don't always want a piece of your mind. And for teachers in particular, be a bit careful. What you say can cause problems if it's not accurate. And even the way you say it can cause problems. So be very careful. And frankly, whether it's a teacher or just any one of us, if we can control our tongues, we are in a marvelous position. Keep your place there with your $50 bill. Turn to Psalms chapter 39. Let's look at a couple of verses to do with our tongues. And how many fights and wars have been started over people saying things that they ought not to have said. And even if they're true, doesn't mean they need to be said. Some true things are best left unsaid. And the ability to hold our tongues, whether what we've got to say is false or true, is false, definitely hold it. But if it's true, well, okay, it might be true, but perhaps best left unsaid. Psalms 39, verse 1, talking of Psalm of David, I said, I will guard my ways, lest I sin with my tongue. You know, David knew the problem. James knew the problem. You know the problem. I know the problem. Our tongues can get us into all sorts of hot water. It continues, I will restrain my mouth with a muzzle while the wicked are before me. And whether it's wicked or somebody else, frankly, a muzzle in our mouths wouldn't be a bad idea sometimes. You know, it's very hard to withdraw what's been said, isn't it? It's very hard. Indeed, once you've said it, it's out there. If you've said something hurtful and you've wounded somebody, you could lose a brother, you know, for the rest of your life by a careless word. And so, you know, James is saying if we can control our mouths, control our tongues, be very careful what we say and do, particularly what we say, we'd be a wise person indeed. Turn to Psalms chapter 34, back a few pages. Psalms 34, starting in verse 12. Who is the man who desires life and loves many days that he may see good? Which says must be all of us. I think we all desire life and plenty of it, thank you very much. We all love many days, particularly many good days. In a long life full of misery wouldn't be much fun, but I think we all desire life and lots of good days, things to look forward to, and year after year of just blessings and prosperity and wonderful experiences. Well, says the psalmist, verse 13, keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking guile. Depart from evil, do good, seek peace and pursue it. And we'll come on to the peaceful part of it later on. But the good person who's going to enjoy a good life, they watch their tongue. And they know that their tongue can get lots of people into trouble. So they guard their tongue. They keep the lips from speaking, you know, guile. The lips aren't devious. They're not forked-tongued. Don't speak out of both sides of the mouth at once. He's a person that speaks what is true, but speaks what's true when it's appropriate to speak what is true. And they do good. And it says they seek peace. And frankly, one way to seek peace and pursue it is not to just blurt out every detail of everything you know. Sometimes peace is best established by a quiet tongue or a few well-chosen, carefully selected words that act as an ointment or a balm, and not sharp words like razor blades that cause all sorts of pain and anguish. Okay, back to James chapter 3. Indeed, verse 3, James 3, still talking of the tongue, we put bits in horses' mouths that they may obey us, and we turn their whole body. And that's true. You can take a huge big horse, one of the sort of, say, a Clydesdale, which I've been close to a few of those, and they are, you know, absolutely amazing, you know, beautiful, stunning horses. The bigger Clydesdales weigh, you know, a full ton. They're over 2,000 pounds in weight. Magnificent specimens. I mean, just and yet you can control them with a small bit in their mouth, just like our tongue is a small portion of our bodies. Or verse 4, look also at ships. Although they are so large and are driven by fierce winds, they are turned by a very small rudder wherever the pilot desires. And even in, you know, Paul's day and James' day, way back in New Testament, some ships were, you know, 600 feet long. There were big vessels then that could carry hundreds and hundreds of, you know, soldiers and so on, and many, many tons of grain and animals being carried around the world. But a small rudder, even in a strong wind, you could maneuver that vessel, you know, quite easily. Even so, the tongue is a little member and boasts great things. Yet, see how great a forest a little fire kindles. And we know that, you know, come summertime, and, you know, somebody just tosses a cigarette into some dry brush, and that very small lit end of a cigarette can burn down hundreds or thousands of acres of forest. A little tiny spark can destroy a forest that's been there for hundreds of years. You know, all those trees, all the animals that live there, the birds, the vegetation, been there perhaps 200 years, 300 years, mature forest, and a little tiny spark can destroy the lot. And, carrying on verse 6, the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity, if used improperly. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature and is set on fire by hell. So, says James, our tongues are dangerous. A little spark can destroy a forest. A little word can destroy families, can destroy governments. It can destroy nations. It can destroy half the world. Our tongues are dangerous. They need to be controlled, especially if you're a teacher, which is the main thrust of James's reference. You know, you teachers, you can destroy with your careless words, but I think we all recognize that in any of our lives, careless words, well, I think that was even the wartime, you know, watch your words. A careless word back in the Second World War, you know, could be overheard by a spy and passed back to perhaps a Nazi Germany and could bring about the death of, you know, 10,000 men. A careless word. Verse 7, for every kind of beast and bird, of reptile and creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind. Well, you know, I've seen elephants at the zoo and in circuses, you know, standing up on their back legs and waving their front, you know, I don't know if they're paws or not, but their front legs in the air. I've seen, been to San Diego several times and seen the killer whales, the orcas, and at Orlando leaping out of the water, having men and women riding on their back and plunging under the water and jumping through hoops, you know. So as James says, even great big killer whales, you know, Shamu and so on, you can tame them. But, verse 8, no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison. You know, it's a problem. Let's face it. The tongue is a problem. Whether you're a teacher, or whether you're just talking complete rubbish with your neighbor, or gossiping over the phone with this other church member, you know, about so-and-so and so. Did you know what they've done? Oh, well, you wouldn't believe it, would you? And then they said this, and then they said that. And here go the wires burning up with poison. You know, it's not impressive. Verse 9, with it we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men or women who have been made in the similitude of God. You know, how can that be, says James? How can we, you know, one part of the day, oh, praise you, God, for your kindness and for calling me, and thank you, God, for your many, many blessings, and oh, God, you're so good to me. and you praised God, and then 1 hour later you're talking to your friend, and oh yeah, and then she said this, and then she said that, and then she said this, and this is what I'm going to do, and I'm going to give her a piece of my mind, and it's like, well, hang on a second, it's the same piece of flesh wagging in your mouth, but the 1 hour is praising God, the next hour it's running somebody down. Verse 10, out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be so. It shouldn't happen. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? Can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olives, or a grapevine bear figs? Thus no spring can yield both salt water and fresh. You shouldn't get cursing and blessing from the same tongue. It just isn't right. Let's hold our place there and go back to Psalms 64. We'll pick up two or three more scriptures about our good old tongues, because our tongues, frankly, could be the death of us if we're not careful. Psalm 64. Of course, the tongues can be kind and uplifting and upbuilding and comfort people and encourage people and build up people. So God gave us our tongues for that reason. Tongues are good when they're used properly, and equally, of course, tongues are evil when they're not. Psalm 64, he's just describing the tongues of evil people, and of course that certainly wouldn't be you and I, would it? But verse 3, who sharpen their tongue like a sword, and bend their bows to shoot their arrows, bitter words. So, you know, our tongues can be like swords, which can wound and frankly can kill. And I guess over the years there probably have been people that have, you know, jumped to their deaths or, you know, taken poisons and been in suicide because of hard things they've heard about themselves. So your tongue can be like a sword. Bend their bows to shoot their arrows, bitter words. So a bitter, twisted, contemptible word is like an arrow. It says, verse 4, that they may shoot in secret at the blameless. Suddenly they shoot at him and do not fear. You don't even know about it. People could talk about you or me behind our backs, say all manner of horrible things about us, like arrows, and they're shot in secret. We may never even know who shot them, but we're at the receiving end of some horrible comments and accusations and so on. And so the tongue is dangerous, particularly in the mouth of evil people. But we've got to watch our tongues as well. If we turn to Ephesians chapter 4, let's pick up two or three instructions addressed to church members. So that brings us into the picture well and truly. Ephesians chapter 4, and looking at verse 29. It says, this is talking now to brethren in the church of God which met in Ephesus. So that's like us really. Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth. Other translations say rotten communication, unwholesome or worthless. What do all those mean? Well, we can think about that a wee bit. Let no worthless, rotten, unwholesome, corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth. But what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers. So you can see the opposite there, really. We should be talking to other people in a manner that is upbuilding, which adds a bit of value, which encourages. At times it may have to be a little bit of an adjustment, you know, a correction that will happen from time to time. But only the best possible taste, said in the best possible way, because you're trying to, you know, build up and to help and to add to people, not to be unwholesome and let no corrupt communication come out of our mouths. Chapter 5 of Ephesians, just a few verses further on, chapter 5, verse 3 and 4, it says, but fornication and all uncleanness or covetousness, let it not even be named among you, as is fitting for saints, neither filthiness, that's of talking this is, not meaning unwashed clothes, neither filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather out of your mouths should come the giving of thanks. Other translations bring out that pausing here, let no vulgarity and let no obscene language. It talks of coarse jesting. Let not those things be found in your mouths. Guard your tongues. Make sure that what you speak is fitting, and things such as the giving of thanks, building people up. You know, don't be coarse in your language. Watch what you say. We turn to Matthew chapter 12. Matthew chapter 12, and starting, I think, in verse 34. Jesus is talking here to the Pharisees and so on, who are always happy to open their mouths and say things that they ought not to have said, and one day they'll regret, particularly as we read a few verses through here. But they were always quick on the draw with their tongues, and plenty of the things the Pharisees said were arrows, bitter words, twisted and destructive and corrupt and so on and so forth. But notice the general principle being brought out here, verse 34. Brood of vipers, how can you, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. Or you could say, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth leaks. Because very often, what's in our hearts sort of leaks out by the things that we say. We can put on a good image, a good facade, but sometimes when we're talking, oops, we just let it slip out, and then somebody who's sharp can think, now I know what they're really like inside. Now I can tell what they're really thinking because it slipped out. They're a bit careless there, and it just leaked out. And as Jesus said, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. You listen to people talking long enough, and you can get an idea what's in their heart. Is it do they talk good things? Is the conversation upbuilding? Or is it negative and destructive? It's quite, as Jesus says here, you know, people speak out of the abundance of their hearts. Verse 35, a good man, out of the good treasure of his heart, brings forth good things by what he says. And an evil man, out of the evil treasure, brings forth evil things. But I say to you that for every idle word men may speak, they will give account of it in the day of judgment. Now, I wonder if Jesus means that. Did he say that for every idle word, we will give account of it in the day of judgment? I wonder if he means every idle word, or does he mean something else? Many translations say that idle is a really careless word. So let's rephrase it that way, because I think the New American Standard Bible and the Analytical Literal Translation gives it this way. But I say to you, verse 36, for every careless word men may speak, or women may speak, and I believe women speak more than men, by the way, according to a number of statistics, they will give account of it in the day of judgment. For by your words you'll be justified, oh my, and by your words you'll be condemned, oh double me my. That's frightening, isn't it? Our words, if they're careless, we need to be watching, because it says here that every single idle or careless word we say, we'll have to give account of it in the day of judgment, and we'll be condemned by our words if we're not careful. Okay, let's go back to James chapter 3. So when James is talking about bridling our tongues and controlling our tongues, he's talking in context about these instructors who want to stand up and pontificate to the brethren about how they should live and so on. But you can see the underlying message is one of all of us will be judged by what we say, and we need to be very careful with our tongues. Verse 13 now, down to the last few verses. Verse 13. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. Well, James is still carrying on the theme of these teachers, these would-be instructors of the brethren, And when it talks about who is wise, well, of course, in the New Testament sort of world, teachers did call themselves, you know, wise men. They were the sages, the instructors. So James is saying, well, okay, if you want to be a teacher, if these teachers are keen to get up there and explain to the brethren how to live and so on, if they want to be instructors, well, let's see if their lives match up to their alleged wisdom. Who is the wise? In other words, who is this good teacher? Who is this person who's going to be able to instruct the brethren? Okay, let him show by good conduct, in other words, his lifestyle, that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. You know, does the person live properly? Are their lives decent? Is it consistent? They claim to be there as a proclaimer of God's laws and truth and so on, but is that what you see in their lives, or is it very different? But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, demonic. You know, a person who claims to be a wise and a great teacher, but in fact all you find is envy and self-seeking, perhaps after it for the money, or perhaps trying to teach to get self-esteem and to be exalted above the brethren and trying to just get a higher position of some sort. Well, that's not godly wisdom. That's not a person who's trying to do the best, you know, for everybody else. That's a person who's acting on their own self-interests. For where envy, verse 16, and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing will be there. But, verse 17, the wisdom that is from above, the one that comes from God, is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality, remember, and without hypocrisy. So James is saying, look, let's be careful about these teachers. If their lives are not consistent with what they talk about, if there is envy, boasting, and jealousy, and people climbing up the ladder, so to speak, that's not wholesome, that's not right, because the wisdom that should motivate a teacher, a wise man, the sort of wisdom you find in a godly wise man, is, as it says in verse 17, that person has a pure life. They are peaceable. They produce peace. They are gentle. They don't fight and argue to get their own way. It says willing to yield. They're full of mercy and good fruits. It says no partiality. Remember James chapter 2. Don't be partial to people. Don't treat one person different to another. And we've probably all seen it. We've seen ministers that you'd always find them sort of rubbing shoulders with the well-dressed and the comparatively wealthy in the congregation. And you find the poorer folk being ignored by the ministers. I've seen that many times. I've looked across at tables and things and seen a minister sitting there and right at the feasts and so on and holy days. And what you find is, of course, some rather well-bred, well-turned-out, relatively prosperous people with the minister. I've heard of ministers, people who visit the minister and been invited to their homes for meals and so on, and it's amazing. Sometimes it seems that the only people who are invited to the minister's house are the relatively well-off, prosperous, decent people. And the poorer folk, if they get there once a year, once every 5 years, or never, you wouldn't be surprised. So, you know, James is saying, look at the lives of these so-called wise people. Is it consistent with God's wisdom, or is it, frankly, motivated by jealousy, selfishness, and so on? If we turn to, let's have a look, 2 Timothy chapter 3, we can pick up a couple of illustrations of the Apostle Paul, because he was a great teacher. Let's see how he lived. 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 10. Paul writes to Timothy, but you have carefully followed my doctrine, manner of life, purpose, faith, long-suffering, love, perseverance. persecutions, afflictions, which happened to me at Antioch, Iconium, Lystra, what persecutions I endured, and out of them all, the Lord delivered me. So, you know, Paul says, Timothy, you know, you've got confidence because you've seen me in action. You've seen my life. You've carefully followed my life. You know what's taking place. You've seen me in action. You've seen my manner of life, the purpose that I've followed. You've seen my faith and my patience and so on and so forth. So, you know, Paul was able to, in a sense, you know, in the right manner, boast that his lifestyle was consistent with his teachings. But not all can do that. Turn back to James, to the last verse of James chapter 3. Then there's a couple more scriptures to finish on after that. James 3 verse 18, concluding this reference to the type of teacher that's doing a good job versus the one that isn't. It says, verse 18, now the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Or one translation says, those who cultivate peace. You know, a man of God, a good teacher who instructs in the truth and instructs in a way that meets people where they need to be met, will produce peace. He will sow peace, cultivate peace, and produce peace. And all of us probably know of congregations where the last thing you'd find any time on a Sabbath is peace. There'll be people in there fighting and arguing and ambitious and pushing to be noticed by the minister and fighting over car parking spaces and everything under the sun. A complete absence of peace, which makes you wonder about, you know, the teacher who has created this atmosphere in which peace doesn't seem to exist. Turn back to 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 24. Two Timothy chapter 2 and verse 24. And Paul's teaching the same thing that James is bringing out. Verse 24, a servant of the Lord, you know, or a teacher, must not quarrel, don't argue with the brethren all the time, but be gentle to all. Gentle, you know, peaceable, able to teach, patient, especially when he's being criticized. Because, you know, very often when you're teaching something, particularly if it's a little bit different to what was expected, you know, people will start to argue and fight and quarrel. But that doesn't mean you get up and slam somebody in the nose because how dare you argue with me? You've got a bad attitude. I'm the minister and you're a pleb. Get back in line. Well, that's not what Paul describes here. We've seen that. I know people. You know people who've been, quotes, suspended, quotes, or invited not to attend because they wanted to debate with the minister, who would not tolerate such a bad attitude. How dare you question my teaching? Dare to hear you. Never turn up again. And it says here, the servant of the Lord mustn't quarrel, but must be gentle to all, even the ones that are difficult to be gentle with, able to teach, patient. This is the wisdom that comes from above, you see, what James is talking about, the wisdom that comes from God, which inspires and motivates the good teacher, is the wisdom that produces good fruit in humility, correcting those who are in opposition. Because sometimes, of course, the minister's wrong, and his teaching's not quite right. If he's humble, he'll recognize that and make adjustments and not banish the person to Mongolia, never to turn up again in case they embarrass him. If God perhaps will grant them repentance so that they may know the truth and that they may come to their senses and escape the snare of the devil, having been taken captive by him to do his will. So the gentle servant is how it's headed in my translation. You know, God's servants should be gentle, humble, certainly preaching the truth and standing firmly by the truth, but correcting people in humility and being gentle and able to teach and patient and producing peace. And then finally, we're down to Matthew chapter 5, get Jesus' words on this, which apply to us all, not just to teachers. But clearly it's important for a teacher to create an atmosphere where there is peace and righteousness and good things, and not have animosity, enmity, jealousy, and people fighting in church, as some particular church groups seem to have rather a lot of. Matthew chapter 5, and starting just in verse 9, Jesus said, "Blessed are the peacemakers," which we know is not the old Colt 45. "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons or daughters of God." You know, peace is a good thing to have. We all want peace of mind. We all want peace among ourselves. We don't want to be fighting and arguing in the church. It's bad enough you've got to fight and argue with the world, you know, Satan's world out there. But certainly among God's people, there should be peace. And one of the sad things, in a sense, if you pick up the Journal newspaper, is there are so many teachers now out there, thousands and thousands of the blighters, and every journal you pick up, you'll get, you know, hundreds of different doctrines being argued and fought over, and letters flying backwards and forwards, and people accusing others of not having God's Holy Spirit, and so on. And really, as James says, stop letting so many be teachers, because if you get up and spout out your ideas and seek to be a great teacher, remember, says James, we'll receive the greater judgment. Okay, brethren, well, we did pretty well there, James chapters 2 and 3. So hopefully next week we'll conclude James with 4 and 5. That'll at least be my objective. Okay, that concludes the Bible study for this week.